And happy Sunday. This is PFG Live. Welcome aboard. It's a beautiful, gorgeous day in southern New Hampshire and elsewhere. Carl Tauber is checking in with 53 degrees and cloudy in the People's Republic of Rhode Island. Finally seeing butts and leaves. I'm not sure that's what you meant. John Thawley is checking in saying the grass is green, the birds are chirping, and it's 68 degrees and sunny near Angel Stadium. Welcome, sir. CJ Stevens is checking in, and he says that he posted his weather in the Discord chat. Okay, we'll get to it in a minute. Art that makes art. Wes is here. We're at about 60 degrees Fahrenheit and currently under a wind advisory. Holy cow. Let's see. And over in the Discord, welcome aboard to Warren Jones, Carl Tauber, DBX, Josh, Daniel, Widgetworks, Spencer, the other one, and Robert Simpson. Welcome aboard, all of you. Let's see. We got some weather reports just plowing in here. Let me see if I can get them for you. Who was first? Well, technically, DBX was first reporting out of White Plains. Where are you? There you are. White Plains reporting winds 300 at 8 knots, visibility 10 miles, sky clear, temperature 08, dew point minus 03, altimeter 3004, remarks are unimportant. Let's see. OC John says he can't get his iPhone to play Discord audio via Bluetooth. So you'll be listening on YouTube. You won't miss anything as long as you're here on YouTube. You're all set. CJ Stevens reports 75 and lots of sun in East Tennessee. Welcome aboard, sir. Josh in Southern Manitoba reports out of Charlie X-ray Mike Delta. Winds are 100 at 07 knots, temperature 05, dew point minus 00. Remarks, can't read them, but adequate. Tuck is reporting in with 68 degrees and drizzly rain in the Buffalo, New York, but he can't make the live. We'll miss you, buddy. Widgetworks says 9 degrees, science, cloudy, just finished raining in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Welcome, sir. Robert Simpson says 68 degrees Fahrenheit and intermittent rain 24 miles northwest of Delta Tango Whiskey, Detroit Metro Airport. Welcome. Sutton, New Hampshire, our own Warren Jones reports a nice 60 degrees or so, sunny, and all remarks are positive. And Josh is giving us an audio check of check. Welcome. What an awesome day. If you have a chance to get outside and get some of that vitamin D, I strongly recommend it. It's particularly good today. Wes says, the wind really doesn't blow here, but a whole bunch passes through to blow elsewhere. That is funny. Hey, a weird week, but a good week. We got a lot done. Yesterday, we were out visiting the mom. And that went well. And today we just basically got our stuff together and going to do a little bit in the shop. Might be on the road doing some errands. But we had an interesting week. And as you could tell from the thumbnail, I got sort of pinged by Dylan from Protium Machining, and Dylan kind of said, you know, I was talking about RA as a roughness measurement, and Dylan said, oh yeah, you need to use RZ. And I'm like, uh-oh. So I did a little research, and RA is like an average roughness in micro. We do it in micro inches. You could also do it in microns. And RZ is essentially, I'm simplifying it, a peak-to-peak measurement of roughness. So it's a harder measurement. Did I speak of the man? Oh, here he is. Protium just showed up. So Protium, you correct me if I'm wrong on any of this stuff. So I ran downstairs and I got my Mitutoyo surface roughness meter, which you see pictured here, and got the toolmaker's flat, which we're going to talk about more, and made my measurements, and I was pretty happy with it. The RA was being measured at 0.7-ish, I think, and the RZ coming in at about 11 micro-inches. And a few people were like, that's pretty good. And then I got some comments after seeing the slide here, the thumbnail. You can see some surface scratches in the toolmaker's flat, which I know about. And I'm here to tell you that those measurements were in the presence of those scratches. So that was pretty good. We're not done with the toolmaker's flat, and in no way is it intended to be done. I have not gone past 3 micron diamond on the laps, so we have not yet brought this in for a landing, but I'm very pleased with how things are going. Carl Tauber says, if you want ringability, isn't RA more important? Well, it's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to that yet. But I will research it, and I will report back. The important thing to understand is that, how do we say this? A whole bunch of PFG lives ago, I did one we called chromoflaticity, in which I was talking about the wavelengths of the departures from flat. And you can go from a very low frequency or long wavelength, in other words, one curve over the entire dimension, or you can have a bunch of ridges, or you could have lots and lots of ridges. So that's like low frequency going to high frequency, if you think of it that way. Carl says, what area do the surface measurements cover? So there is a standard for this measurement. And if you look at the picture, it says in the display, it says ISO 1997. That's a standard for the measurement. And basically, it drags, I'm going to call it a phonograph needle, and I'm going to get some grief for this, but it drags a probe across the surface. The distance over which it calculates the numbers is part of the standard. And of course, the pressure it pushes down on it and the profile of the probe, all of that is part of the standard. And then you do the math that's in the standard after you measure your probe going across. So we care about the fact that lower is better, right? We want smaller numbers for RA. And I was looking in some of my previous posts, and we were getting RAs off of the grinder. Well, recently we got RAs on the toolmaker's flat off of the grinder in the neighborhood of 12-ish. Okay, and now we're getting RAs after lapping of 0.7-ish. So you can see that you're actually making a measurement here, right? But what I don't have any history with until I got kicked in the butt by Protium is RZs, because I just haven't been playing with them. So now we're going to put that into our vocabulary. Carl asks, so it's actually a line measurement, not an area. Correctamundo. Not only that, but I could show you some of the pictures. Let's see. I think the picture started here. So if you look at these pictures, I took an X and a Y measurement, and I took an RA and an RZ in X, and an RA and an RY. An RA and an RZ in Y. So I did these at 90 degrees to each other, just to see if there's any major differences. And no, there was no huge differences. There are your numbers. So that's how you measure surface roughness. Now, that tells you nothing about surface shape. In other words, it doesn't know about really low frequency or long wavelength departures from flat. It knows about the relatively high frequency departures from flat. Protean Machining says RA is likely the more, quote, real world measurement, as most drawings specify RA. RZ is just more telling of the, quote, smoothness, close quote, at a microscopic level. I think that's a great way to explain it. So let me tell you the story about the leap that I made. I don't remember if we had that done. Yeah, I can't quite remember. But when I started lapping the flat, I was lapping it with my 3-micron flats in the condition they were in from previous lapping. So I got into the habit of leaving the laps as they were and not cleaning them. And that, I think, was a mistake. And that came from my misunderstanding of, you know, Robin suggested doing the closed moat around the lap so that you don't keep dribbling your diamonds out, you know, your slurry out the sides. And that led me to not clean the flats, clean the laps, which was fine in the short term, especially when you're working on a particular project. But what I ended up doing was I left them like that. And in the first lapping that I did for last week, I lapped them and I wanted to have something for show and tell. And they came out flat, as evidenced by the optical flat measurements, but they came out with this very dark gray color, and I didn't like that, and it certainly wasn't where we were heading. So finally, I scrubbed the flats clean, or the laps clean, and in fact, you saw that in a couple of Instagram posts, and the goo that came off of the laps was, it wanted to be cleaned. So we got that cleaned up. And then the first lapping after that was, okay, fine. Now we're cooking with steam. So the message is that, or my new procedure is that I'm going to scrub the laps clean prior to every lapping session, but I will, you know, not clean them during the lapping session so we can use all of our diamonds. That's my approach going forward. The numbers we're getting and the visual appearance of the lap was pretty good. Let me grab a slide here that shows maybe a tighter picture here of what the laps look like, or the flat looks like. So this is the picture. I think this is the picture I derived the thumbnail from, but the color is that bright chromium rich color, and I'm very happy with it. DBX says, I heard phonograph needle. So do we have RA and RZ for a good pressing of the Jimi Hendrix Experience Monterey Pop? Asking for a friend. No. However, if you provide a sample, I will provide back measurements, and we'll have the numbers. A perfectly reasonable request, by the way. And the NIST, they want to know about it. So there you go. So not a lot of progress this week on the whole lapping front, but very good progress. And I'm liking it. I'm also liking the lapping station that I built. It's really excellent. And being able to lap, turn around, go to the sink, clean it, go over to the optical flat, measure it. It's a very tight physical loop, and it's working out really well. Protean says you should try one of the Frasia NX cutter prior to grind sometime. I'd be interested to see how much easier it is to grind and or lap. We'll have to talk. You've gotten sub 4 RA in stainless. I absolutely believe that. When I turned these on the lathe, I knew they were going to the grinder. So I didn't go crazy on the lathe. I'll be honest. I used whatever my insert was and I went. Coming off the grinder, it was pretty nice. But sub 4 RA off a lathe is pretty cool. Pretty neat. Like I said, we were getting 11-ish, RA 11-ish off of the grinder. And obviously that was good enough to bring it in for a landing with the lap. So my plan, I have to add a new tray to my station, or at least to the collection. I may not have them both out at once. We'll see. But the new tray is going to support two more laps, and that's going to be 1 micron diamond. I like to work in threes. So we'll have 3 micron diamond for roughing. 1 micron diamond might bring it in to done. We'll see. And I will acknowledge that Robin and I had some conversations about some other techniques, which are not developed yet. But that might be another thing to add to bring in the final lapping. But I'm very happy with that. I also sent sent out some pictures of what we did, of the results, to somebody who's quite interested, and I'm waiting to hear back from them. Thank you for the link there, Protium. Frasia, nice. I will check it out. That's for a milling cutter. Yeah, we used, that's amazing that you're getting 4 RA out of a milling cutter. That's pretty cool. I'll check it out. So the successes so far include the lapping station. The laps are working really well. The holder, I know this seems trivial, but the holder, the 3D printed holder that allows me to move it around without imparting the heat from my hand, that worked out really well. And it lets you manipulate it such that you don't have to push down to move it. You can move it around just by sideways pressures, which is also very important. So all good. So that's the update in the lapping department. Very happy with how that came out. Looking forward to bringing it into what I consider finished. Interestingly, when Johansson did his gauge blocks way back when, before bringing it to Ford, the legend goes that he converted a sewing machine to a lapping machine. However, I have never seen a picture of his primordial machine, and I've never seen an accurate description of what he did. I'm not saying we have to reproduce that, but I would be interested to see what he was doing, especially since I was busy using a machine that meets that description earlier this week, and I was doing some sewing, and I was thinking about that whole story about Johansson. So if anybody has any additional information, specifics about Johansson and his machine, I'd love to hear it. Not that I'm going to convert this sewing machine, because this sewing machine has actually got work to do. By the way, this is from my mom. This was a present to my mom on her wedding. So it's about 70 years old. And I was with my mom yesterday. We were talking about it. And it's running like the day it was made. So yeah, I want to learn more about that sewing machine from Johansson. That would be very, very interesting. So that's the update on lapping. So then the question came up from a buddy of mine: can you automate it? And the answer, of course, is yes. So one of the guys I follow on Instagram is Extra Minty Matt. He's an optician. By the way, Matt, you have an open invitation to come on and do a PFG Live. But they, if you look at a picture of the kind of work he does and where he works, they have a, you know, many machines sitting there running in an automated fashion, or at least a semi-automated fashion, so that, you know, the operator is not standing there doing the lapping of lenses. In this case, it's lenses. But if you have to do, you know, one thing, one of these things a month, or two of these things a month, it doesn't make any sense. And you'd have to agree that even if you had to machine some things, if you had to make one or two a month, when do you automate? When do you go CNC? So the answer is, yes, there are things we can do. I don't know if I'm going to get involved with doing it. DBX, as I expected you to, put a picture of Johansson's sewing machine in the chat. This deserves further study. We'll have to, So DBX beat Josh to it. Sorry, Josh. That's the picture I have. That's all. But you know what? If you look for more information, I'm not sure you're going to find it. So here's my challenge to you guys doing the research. Find the highest resolution version of that photo, and let's look at it closely. It would be a lot of fun to figure out what was going on there. And let's just recognize that we are currently using the technology that was developed on that sewing machine. How many years later? What's the year on that DBX? I can't read it. Isn't that fantastic? So we will get on with it. And today you could buy a steel gauge block, which is generally 52-100 steel, the same steel we're messing with. You can buy a ceramic gauge block. You could buy a carbide gauge block. I'm probably missing something. All for different reasons. Oh yeah, there's another cool picture from Stockholm, 1948. The book was from 1948, and it shows somebody holding a stack of gauge blocks. There has to be 25 gauge blocks in the stack, and the stack has to be about 20 inches long, and they're holding it horizontally. Anyway, if you're watching on video, you're seeing all sorts of cool pictures showing up here. And it should be pointed out that the ability to ring, we talked about this before, is not yet completely understood. I found a paper that I wanted to get, the abstract of which talks about ringing and new discoveries in what makes ringing happen. And I could not pull the paper. I tried all my resources, and the paper was behind a $42 paywall. Kind of bummed me out. But we'll find it, and we'll get it. It would be nice to see if there was any additions. Protium found a pic of his reading. This is from your milling? That is very impressive. 3RA microinches and 25 microinches RZ. Not bad, man, for milling. That is awesome. So if you're looking at the picture, Protium is using a MAHR roughness meter, and that's pretty neat. Very nice. I like the roughness meters because they quantify something that we tend to not quantify. So there's no questions. There's a number on it. Do you have a calibration item for that? Because I do for the Mitutoyo. I have 118 microinch standard that you can read. Oh, it's built into the unit. Oh, isn't that neat? Well, just another toy that you all need to get is a roughness gauge. You can also get these little sample plates that have about eight or nine or ten little squares showing you what the roughness looks like, and you could do a visual comparison to approximate the measurement, and that's also pretty cool. So that's lapping from RA to RZ. We will put numbers on these things instead of saying real smooth. Oh, and I was asked, am I getting ringability yet? And the answer is not quite yet. I have a couple of 1-inch pucks which ring together, and I use them on the toolmaker's flat, and we're not there yet. We're getting close, but I will keep you posted. So that's the story. So if you guys have any questions about any of that stuff, put it in the chat and we'll try to answer it for you. Very satisfying process, though. Strongly recommended. And when we're done with this side to where we get a process that we think we like, I'm going to protect that side with polyester tape. I'm going to flip it over, and then we will apply the recipe to the other side and see if, in fact, it brings it right in for a landing. And then we have a full recipe for the toolmaker's flat. Stay tuned. We will let you know. WidgetWorks is typing, so we'll wait to see if this is on topic. Meanwhile, I'll have a little sip of tea just to wet my whistle. Okay. I was listening to WidgetWorks asks, are you shooting for parallelism as well? The answer to that is yes. Although it's less critical, and we're getting pretty ridiculous parallelism off of the grinder, so that the lapping should not have a big impact on it. We'll measure it. But the as ground flat, we were getting 25 millionths deviation over the whole thing, basically half of 50 millionths. So it was holding pretty nicely, or that 25 micro inches over 3 inches is what we were getting. So we'll keep you posted on that. But really the flat and the ringability are the main things we're looking at, for reasons. We have reasons. There's reasons. Like many of you, I was listening to, I think it was John Grimsmo. It was either the Business of Machining podcast, highly recommended, or it was one of the John Grimsmo videos. But he was talking about, it was Business of Machining. So John and John were talking about John having trouble with a Bluetooth-connected probe in his brother, milling machine. And they said, that sounds like a Spencer Webb problem. So I'm like, okay, I got the message, guys. So I wanted to, it was on this week's podcast. Thank you very much. So I wanted to get into that a little bit. And, you know, I'm going to cross the streams, bring a little bit of antenna wisdom into this discussion of precision machining. So if you don't know, my principal business is as an antenna consultant and engineer. I design antennas, I build antennas, I test antennas, I kibitz about antennas. And that's what I've been doing now for, believe it or not, 30 years. So that's my main gig. And my entire machining interest started because I had to make my own prototypes. So that's what hooked me into machining, and it's just been downhill the whole time. So I want to talk a little bit about wireless devices in the shop, mostly because we can't get away from them, right? We have them in our pockets. Nobody walks around without one of these things in their pockets. But now we have Bluetooth devices creeping into our shop equipment. So I want to talk about what I see when I walk, you know, if you make me put my antenna hat on and we walk into a shop, I see the metal surfaces. They're basically, they act like reflectors. I see the drywall basically acts like attenuators. In other words, radio signals will be attenuated as they try to go through the drywall. I see noisemakers, fluorescent bulbs, LED bulbs. Believe me, LED power supplies are very noisy. You know, if you have solar panels on your roof, the inverter or inverters that are turning the solar energy being collected by the panels into AC or whatever, those are making noise. So those are the things I see when I walk into an environment like the shop, not to mention your machines. Okay. So motor controllers are potential sources of noise. So if you introduce a wireless device into that environment and you're hoping that it works really well, you have some risks. And if we zoom in on, let's just make believe we know what John's problem is. If you zoom in on like a Brother milling machine and you look at a probe in there and you imagine that has a Bluetooth interface in it, well, now you have a transmitter, a Bluetooth transmitter, and potentially its receiver. I don't know where the receive side is. In fact, I would love John to show up and tell me. Hi, Robin. Robin just checked in. Welcome aboard. But what I see is a box that has, yes, it has some windows, but it's an echo chamber. And there's a problem with that. And we'll talk about that in a second. So there's a lot of things going on. One of the problems that is not obvious is what we call a multipath null. What does that mean? If you have a receiver and a transmitter, and they can see each other, right? Their line of sight, you get a signal directly, line of sight, no problem. But if that transmitter also bounces a signal off of something, the ceiling, a wall, the side of a machine, and that same signal reaches the receiver, now you have two signals coming into the receiver. If they are exactly in phase, they reinforce, and it's stronger. If they're exactly out of phase, they will cancel, and you will have a null. So, interesting, Protium says the RF probes, like Grimsmo's, are meant for things like horizontals, where line of sight can be limited and a traditional IR one might not work. So that's an excellent point. What I will need to know, and I have not done this, okay, I have not put eyes on the situation, but I want to see, I know what the transmit side looks like. It's a probe, and I believe me, I know what the antenna inside looks like. I've designed a dozen of them. That's an understatement. But I want to see what the receive side looks like. Because I'll tell you what, if the receive side is a little hockey puck on the side of the machining volume, we have a problem. And I suspect that that's exactly what's going on. Because if you have a single point of transmission and a single point of reception, you can have multipath, which causes a null. You could literally be standing at the transmitter. I can see the receiver, or vice versa, and get no signal because you have a direct signal and another signal being reflected and they're exactly canceling. And that's what we call a multipath null. And the more reflections you have, the higher the probability that you're going to find a multipath null. Now, the good news is you can fix that sometimes by literally moving a couple of inches and be out of the multipath null. But there's no guarantee. So I'm going to give everybody a little experiment to do. Your microwave oven in your kitchen, and like everybody has one now, is a perfect example of an echo chamber by design. And the radio frequency energy inside this echo chamber is 2.451 gigahertz, or 2451. I'm sorry, I got that wrong. 2451, I believe, is the center frequency for microwave ovens. And it's a pretty wide band because it's not super tightly controlled. Protium says the RF probes are meant for... Okay, so we have a picture of the Bloom probe. Is that the probe that Grimswell has? Because if that's the whole thing, the problem is evident. Bloom, call me. Call me. We'll talk. Yeah, okay. Yeah, Robert Simpson says, eggs make good microwave testers. Yes, they do. Once. So... here's what I want you to do. Most microwaves have like a big rotary table, which is a hint. Lift your rotary table up and put four coffee mugs under it so that it's off of the rotisserie. Take a paper towel, make it wet, squeeze out the extra water, and lay the paper towel on your round plate. Okay? Now, set your timer for 1 minute and start the microwave, but keep your finger hovering right over the stop button. If you watch it, you will note that your paper towel is going to dry out in some areas. And as soon as you see them dry out, a couple of them dry out, hit the stop button. Now, observe your paper towel. So if you take out your Sharpie, okay, at that point, I want you to go to all the dry areas and put a dot in it. And you're going to see a pattern emerge. And the pattern is a pretty regular grid of dry spots interspersed by wet spots. And you will also note that the distance from the dry spots to the wet spots are a multiple of 1.2 inches. That's crazy. But that's because of the frequency of the signal that is causing what we call a standing wave pattern inside the microwave. And the purpose of the rotisserie in there is to average out the fact that there's going to be hot spots and cold spots. Now, as soon as you put your roast in there, it's going to change the cavity and those spots are going to move around. But the message is that it's not uniform. The cold spots in there are analogous to multipath nulls, and the dry spots in there are analogous to multipath hotspots because there's lots of paths bouncing around in the oven. At 2.4 gigahertz, a half wavelength is 2.4 inches. That's a very convenient thing to remember, by the way. 2.4 gigahertz. A half wavelength or a dipole is 2.4 inches. Isn't that neat? So if you're inside a machine and you're running a probe that uses Bluetooth or 2.4 gigahertz signaling of any kind, and you have one place for that receiver, I am here to tell you that is a dangerous design. There's a solution which all the manufacturers should be using, which is called diversity reception. You already use this on your, and some of them may have it under the hood and may not be obvious. But if you go to Best Buy and you buy a wireless access point and it has two antennas on it, or these days it has like five antennas on it, okay, that is a multipath mitigation technique called diversity reception. Yes, that relationship is absolutely linear. It's inversely linear. So the higher the frequency, the shorter the wavelength. Here's the formula, folks. I know I promised you no math, but I lied. 300 divided by the frequency in megahertz gives you the wavelength in meters. Because light travels 300 time, 300 million meters per second. Okay, so it, now that you're starting to understand this, when you think of things in terms of, oh, that's 2.4 gigahertz, and you know that 4.8 inches is a full wavelength, and you look at a machine, and it's like, well, it's about 10 of those. Well, now you're in the danger zone, right? If you're looking at things that are hundreds of wavelengths, it plays by optical rules. If you look at things that are a fraction of a wavelength, it plays by what we call near field electrical rules. But when you get into the 1, 2, 10 wavelengths sizes, things are weird, okay? Let's see. Carl says, didn't you say that an Endfire helical antenna has good multipath rejection? Yes and no, Carl. If the transmitted signal is circularly polarized and the receive antenna is circularly polarized, then you have excellent multipath rejection. And Warren Jones just posted a picture. You mean like this? Yes. So there's a picture of a wireless router or something. Is that a Ubiquiti that has four antennas on it? So the probability is that one of those antennas is not in a multipath null. So if one is in a multipath null, the chances of the other one being in a multipath null is small. So you can switch and you can figure out which one is. Oh, it's your Wi-Fi extender thingy. Yeah, we'll talk more. I have opinions about those. So I am going to help John when we get a chance to talk, which we have not had, figure this out. But it's a very, you know, inside of a machine to use 2.4 gigahertz is a very dangerous decision. You're better off using IR. What's infrared? Infrared is just another electromagnetic signal. It's just a much smaller wavelength. Let's put it in perspective. Your visual sensitivity to light goes from about 300 nanometers to about 700 nanometers, okay? I believe those are approximately correct. So we're talking about the difference between, you know, it's still a tiny wavelength, but it's, we could put numbers to it. We could measure it, right? We're not, it doesn't scare us. So by using a much smaller wavelength, then the multipath effects, you're no longer in the vicinity of, you know, 1, 3, 10, 30 wavelengths of size of the box that you're in. It's now acting like a great big box, and multipath is no longer the issue. There are other issues. As Protean pointed out, being able to see the infrared, you know, in the machine might be really hard to do just because of the geometry. Then they want to use RF. But I'll tell you what, I would feel a lot more comfortable if when, you know, Acme Probe Company came along and said, here's your probe, and here's two different hockey pucks in two different corners of the machine that are going to listen to your probe. I feel way better about that than here's the one hockey puck that's going to listen to your probe. The other thing you got to watch for is if there are claims that they use two antennas and they're doing diversity, you have to ask, well, how far apart are the two antennas? So if they're less than a wavelength apart, they're doing nothing. It's not helping. They have to be a couple of wavelengths apart to probably be in completely different multipath situations. I know that this was a lot to dump on you in one swell foop, but this is of concern. You could extend this now to thinking about Wi-Fi in your shop. You know, how many people have Wi-Fi? Warren Jones, we were just talking to Warren. Warren is presently listening to this sitting outside in the great outdoors. But I know that when Warren's in his shop, he's in a metal box. And that whole situation is problematic. So maybe you could just start looking at things a little differently now and you start seeing, oh, I'm in a metal box and I have no cell reception and I think I understand why now. If you have any questions and you're able to put them in the chat, feel free to do it. But these are problems that I solve on a daily basis, and I've been doing it for 30 years, so I can go on for hours about this. Another issue, of course, I brought it up briefly, is noise. So if you have an opportunity, for example, in setting up Wi-Fi in your shop, if you have the opportunity to make a decision as to whether you're going to use the 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi or the 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi, there is no question you should always use the 5 gigahertz option. I know in my Wi-Fi system, you can tell it to prefer the 5 gigahertz, and that's what we do. We say, if you can drag your client over to a 5 gigahertz channel, do that. And the reasons are multiple, but the biggest one is noise and just it's crowded. 2.4 gigahertz is ridiculously crowded. All these devices, the microwave ovens, you effectively have three channels on 2.4 gigahertz. Did you know that? You'll hear talk about 11 channels. That's utter nonsense because they're so wide. And in order to not overlap, you have channel 1, channel 6, and channel 11. And effectively, that's what you have. And channel 6, guess what's in the middle of channel 6? Microwave ovens. So 5 gigahertz has over 100 channels. It's like the great outdoors. Use 5 gigahertz. Warren says, I work in steel buildings and often you have to go outside to use the cell phone or to send a photograph or whatever. Yes, absolutely. And don't be lured into the, oh, just plug in this extender and it's going to fix all your problems. A good system will have multiple wireless access points and it will do the right thing as best it can. So Josh says he played an MMO, that's a massive multiplayer online game, with a guy on Wi-Fi, and every time somebody used the microwave, he would get knocked offline. Absolutely. So again, if you can, these days, almost every phone can do 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi, no problem. If you can influence your system to use 5 gigahertz, please use 5 gigahertz. There's so much crap in the 2.4 gigahertz band, it's not funny. It's really not funny. Pixel says, my campus consists of lots of massively thick concrete buildings, and you see weird square access points all over the place. I was told they were there to bring cell service indoors. So there are microcells or nanocells also, and they suffer the exact same problems. So having multiple of those things, and frequently they'll hang on a network to relieve the cellular bands and get your cellular signal onto, you know, a network cable as quickly as possible. We were just down at MIT in the tunnels. Yes, we were in the tunnels. And sure enough, every now and then, there was a tunnel-based access point, and the Wi-Fi was excellent. So that is absolutely true. WidgetWorks says, correctly, I might add, that's why I have everything in the shop wired, if possible. Guess what? Same thing here. We try to have everything wired. I have a camera that gets knocked offline when we use the microwave oven because it's a wireless camera, and that will not be wireless very long. So noise sources. So if you know, it's very hard for the average person without special equipment to diagnose that part of your problem is noise. But if you can correlate, and I have a funny story about that, if you can correlate turning something on activating a motor, with losing a connection on your Wi-Fi, and if you could repeat that correlation, you're on the way to solving the problem. There are ways to solve noise problems from motor controllers and other stuff, and that's something we could talk about. So if you end up in that situation as a member of our community and you want to talk to me about it, happy to help. Pixel says, relieving the cell towers is something I didn't consider. That's neat. I wonder how coordinating that with cell providers works. The cell providers desperately want you off the air. They want you into something. So a lot of places you can get in your home or shop, you can get your own nano cell. Okay. It looks like a Wi-Fi, you know, it looks like a router, but it's literally a cell tower. And if they can get your cell phone off of the network into the internet quickly, it relieves the cell network, and they like that. WidgetWork says, there are cell phone apps that can show some of the noise, not perfect, but better than nothing. Absolutely. Happy to help, Pixel. This is a deep topic, but specifically with respect to your machine shops, there are issues here. So the funny story is that I have been playing on the Discord server with what we call webhooks, which is ways to have another system shoot a message in to the Discord server. And we have a channel that does that right now. And I have a private channel that's doing some experiments. One of the experiments is when my surveillance system loses a camera, it will send a message to that channel. It's not a public channel. As soon as I implemented that, I was able to 100% correlate the microwave oven turning on with that camera getting its signal lost. Awesome. So, you know, sometimes you trip over it, but there you go. Yeah, there you go. So QD Smits, who's in Finland, says, I used to have digital cable TV more than 10 years ago. Sorry, I apologize. The Netherlands. QD Smits is in the Netherlands. He says, different channels would drop out when using the wireless DECT phone or the microwave. Yes, exactly correct. So I'm going to close this with one last comment, because again, this can go on for a long time. And that is, there are no quick fixes that if something seems too good to be true, it's too good to be true. One of these things is called a passive repeater. Passive meaning you don't have to plug a box in that doesn't use any electricity, where you're going to put an antenna inside and it leads to an antenna outside and you've solved your problems. No, do not waste your time. If you are offered that, if you see that advertised, the answer is no. And you could do the math to show why the probability of that working is nearly zero. But I'll just leave you with that. There are systems where you have a box, you plug it in, and it literally is a repeater. It receives your signal, it translates it perhaps to a different frequency, it shoots it up, shoots it out, and vice versa. Those are real, okay? But anything that says it's going to solve your problem passively is not real. As you can tell, I'm a little passionate about this. But again, if any of you guys want to talk about this, we can get deeper into it. Yeah. Okay, DBX. Balanced power. Or you could spin your electrons. If you spin all your electrons, that also helps a lot, really. Okay. I know we're going to get one more comment on this here. Everybody's typing. Robert Simpson says, ether winds. Yes, the ether winds, they blow. We so depend on these electronic devices too. If you can ever replace a wireless link in your shop with a wired link in your shop, do that. Okay, so the brief topic is the joy of unnecessary precision. A lot of times we hear people wanting to hit a tolerance within a tenth. I want to hit this within a tenth. And if you look at the Pixel just posted a picture of an old AT&T tower. Yeah, those are called, those antennas on top there, Pixel, they're called cornucopia antennas. And they have a storied past. Those were used to make connections across the country for long distance. Yeah, long lines. Exactly right. So we get a part to make, and we say, I'm gonna hit this within a tenth. And we hit it within a tenth. You know, you get a good tool, you get a good process, you compensate for this, compensate for that, change your work holding. And then you look at the print and it says plus or minus 5/1000ths. So this is sort of something that bugs me, in that if you're doing something for the joy of doing it, you know, if you're doing it because you enjoy precision, believe me, we all like that sort of thing. That's awesome. But if somebody's paying you to make a part and you're spending 10 hours hitting a tenth when you could have spent 3 hours and shipped it out the door, you're sending money down the toilet. It's either your client's money that's going down the toilet or it's your money that's going down the toilet. Neither of these are good. So what I like to hear, you know, and I think John Saunders was talking about this, is you have tolerances on parts for a reason. And the designer, who should have sat down and looked at tolerances and said, okay, this part is going to be plus or minus 2/2000ths of an inch. It's going into this thing, which is plus or minus 2/1000ths of an inch. The nominal values of those dimensions are spaced this much, not always obvious, by the way. And if the parts are inside that band, you're done. Everything goes together. And if the parts fall outside that band, you probably have a problem. But it's the designer's job to set the tolerance on the part, and it's the machinist's job to hit the tolerances. So if you have a part that says this is 1 inch plus or minus 10/1000ths, and you have a part that comes in at 1 inch plus 9/1000ths, you send that part along. You're done. And if you say, well, gee, where'd the 9/1000ths come from? It's okay to toss it in the back of your head, but if you're going to spend, you know, 2 hours getting that thing dialed to only 1/1000th over instead of 9/1000ths over when it was in spec in the first place, you're pissing away money. And that's the message, is don't do that. And it's not the machinist's job to figure out those tolerance bands. It's the designer's job. They could be the same person. But the designer has to be thinking about the tolerance stack up. And it's not trivial. It's not easy. Because especially, I think it was also in that business of machining, we're talking about, like, gee, in an airplane, there must be an incredible tolerance stack up. Yeah. And that's why the guys sitting at the drawing board designing this stuff, that's what makes it hard. So if you ever catch yourself on a revenue project trying to hit 1/1000th when 10/1000ths will do, I want the light bulb to go on and say, gee, maybe this is not worth spending time on. However, if you're having fun in the shop and you're improving your skills and you're trying to see how good you can do, go for it. Have a ball. I do that. A bunch of us do that. And I say, let it rip. Spencer R. By the way, Spencer, I saw a post this week from the MIT rifle team. Now, if you don't know my history, I was on the MIT pistol team. The MIT rifle team now has a Spencer, and that's awesome. But Spencer R. says, my dad just had this at work. The prototype parts of a production job were all cut to plus or minus 2/10 when the tolerance called out for plus or minus 5/1000. Production parts came in and half the parts didn't fit together. So who's going to get yelled at? I'll tell you who should get yelled at. The designer, okay, not the machinists. Because if they delivered what the drawing asked for, it's not their problem. And with that, I'm going to wrap it up here. I'm going to keep today tight. This is fun. We're going to be over in the Discord server in the after party roundtable when this has closed. I will respectfully request that you subscribe. You could like if you want, but subscribe so you're here for next time and help us figure out this stuff. If you don't have a set of PFG stones, what are you even doing? Go to pfgstones.com and find something you need. This week, you know, sometimes the planets align. This week, people needed nozzles. I make a custom coolant nozzle, which focuses the coolant, and it works really well. All of the PFG stones are ground using the nozzle, and I suddenly got a pile of nozzle orders, so that was kind of interesting. So the nozzle production is up. Yeah, come join us on the Discord server. Go to pfg.gg/links, and all the links for stuff we talk about is in there, including a link to the Discord server, and you're welcome to come and join us. Also, on the YouTube channel, there is a video called How to Get on Our Discord Server, and it walks you through, even if you don't even know what I'm talking about and you don't know what Discord is, it will walk you through getting on. Let's see. I think we covered it. I think we cleared out all the pipes. You guys are awesome. Have a great week. Enjoy the spring. Go do something in the shop that is accurate, but not too accurate. Get flat, stay flat, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.